Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks so much for joining us. Today we're talking about incarceration and, in particular, how incarceration affects families. The United States has the highest prison population rate in the world. Many of the people we put away are parents of young children. In Maryland alone, an estimated 82,000 children have had a parent in jail or prison at some point during their childhood. That's one out of every 15 kids in Maryland. What does it mean for a kid when dad is doing time? What if it's mom? And what if a lot of kids in the same community are dealing with a parent away in prison or jail? The Annie E. Casey Foundation has just released a report seeking to answer such questions. The report finds that when a parent spends time behind bars, family finances can descend into a death spiral, and not surprisingly, emotional bonds between parents and children suffer. These and other effects tend to last far beyond the parent's homecoming and even touch neighboring families whose parents are not incarcerated. The Annie E. Casey Foundation's Ryan Chow is here to talk through the findings with us. He is Vice President for Civic Sites and Community Change. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you.
And Joe Jones, President of the Center for Urban Families, is also with us. Thanks for being here today.
Good to be here.
Ryan Chow, I want to get into the details of the report and certainly the recommendations, but I feel like I have to ask first, because I think some listeners are thinking, isn't separation from families part of the punishment? Isn't that kind of built in when someone is convicted of a crime?
Well, we don't think it should be, because the people who are punished are those who did not commit the crime. It's the children and families who are affected, and as our report details, in ways that create trauma that can last their entire lifetime. So we don't feel like that should be considered as part of the sentence. It's simply not fair to sentence a child along with a parent.
But is it possible to have incarceration without having those effects? I mean, are you essentially saying there should not be incarceration of parents?
We're not saying that. I think certainly one thing we're encouraged by is the movement around criminal justice reform, reforms around tough-on-crime policies generally. But what we are saying is that we need to consider the collateral effects on children and families and to support families during the time when a parent is away, and to support that person who returns, their whole family, when they return so that they can reengage and have the opportunities everyone deserves.
Yeah, and we are going to talk in detail about that. Joe Jones, before I ask you a question, I want to play a clip for our listeners. Producer Andrea Appleton spoke yesterday with a client at your center, the Center for Urban Families. He has three children and served time for drug distribution, among other convictions.
My name is Rondolia Stallings, Jr. I did over approximately over 11 years in and out of prison, back and forth since I've been 19 up to the age of 33. And it's very difficult being away from your children, as far as not being able to raise them in a property home with both parents, especially when it comes to your son. Being a man, an African-American man in this world nowadays, it's very important the father's in the home for structure for the family. At the time I first got incarcerated, I only had two kids. My son was 7 days old. I went from being able to hold him to not even getting to see him for at least, like 3 or 4 months going through the process of going through diagnostics and being housed, where are you going to go? So that played a real big part. And it was like the bond is not as strong as I wanted it to be. And my daughter was 2 years old. The first time I did 2.5 years. So when I came home, he was walking and talking. It was like him meet me all over again when I came home. My daughter, she more accepting to me when I came home, because she was already of age when I left, and her being able to see me on the visits made a difference too. They was coming like at least twice a month, and every other month we had family day, and they also got to come and had contact visits. When you're in medium security, you can't touch the kids because it's through a glass, but when you go to minimum, you're able to get contact visits. It makes a big difference when you get to see your kids and they want to reach out and kiss you and hug you. And it really plays a big part on your mental, because you want to be able to touch them, because they want to be able to touch you, but you can't, and that really hurts. My son, the older he get, me not being there, it's like he holds a grudge against me not being in his life. And I can understand, because I didn't have a father growing up. But I'm also going through a situation with my youngest child that I have custody over, my youngest daughter, where her mother's incarcerated right now. and her being a little girl, being raised by her father, it's a little difficult because a lot of things that I don't know, the teacher, as far as being a woman, I just can do what I see my mother and my sister do. So that's like my biggest problem right now with incarceration and parenting.
Rondolia Stallings Jr. describing the effect incarceration has had and is continuing to have on his family. His children are now 15, 12, and 8 years old. He's been out of prison for 3 years. Joe Jones, how typical is Rondolia Stallings' description of being a father incarcerated and having a wife incarcerated?
I think, you know, it's pretty typical for folks who are incarcerated, parents who are incarcerated. We have not, as a society, I'm thinking about the question you had asked Ryan. You know, we haven't figured out how to help parents manage prison. Yes, when you commit a crime, you deserve to, be punished for it. You know, I'm an ex-offender, and there were times when I committed crimes, and I needed to pay, my debt to society. But, when folks make mistakes, you don't want to double down on the mistake relative to the impact on children. And we want to figure out how do we manage that time away so that children aren't negatively impacted by their separation, because it's difficult to, without the proper tools, to have children to internalize what happened. So often the existing caregivers don't know how to help a child process it. So a child has that separation, even going to the prison and visiting the parent, but then they lay their head down on a pillow at night. And before they fall off to sleep, they're trying to figure out what is it I just experienced, that abrupt separation or that visit to the prison where I saw my parent behind bars. And then, they're left to their own devices. And when you leave little people to their own devices without the proper tools, you end up with bad results.
Wow. So proper tools means what?
Well, one, you want to make sure that when parents are away, you want to determine, what is the best caregiving setting for the kids? Who are the caregivers that remain behind that the children can be with so that they have consistent caregivers? You also want to have sentences that help to determine a person's parental situation so that wherever the person is sent away to, at least it's in close proximity to where the family is. When you send people away miles and miles away from their home and the children remain, in that community, then it's very difficult for that family to travel to where that person is incarcerated. So all those things
and
need to be
in your experience with your clients, you don't find courts taking that into account?
It's indiscriminate. It's all over the place. It just depends. And unfortunately, there's no universal kind of set of standards that help our system of incarceration or criminal justice to make kind of the right kind of choices. And that's why the report that the Casey Foundation has produced with recommendations is so critically important to help us to begin to think about how we manage this situation. We want to help. We want to also have people to pay their debt, but we also don't want to have negative consequences for our children, because we don't want them to repeat the same cycle as their parents, and we pay for their incarceration and for the internal, struggles that they will face when their parents are away.
Yeah, the report, when we'll link to it from the midday page at WIPR, the report is titled A Shared Sentence, The Devastating Toll of Parental Incarceration on Kids, Families, and Communities. Ryan Chow, what would you say is the most striking finding? Because some of what's in the report we certainly have heard before, including its criticism of over-incarceration, especially of African-Americans. What do you think people should focus on that will give them some new insights here?
Yeah, well, you're right. These aren't, as a whole, new revelations. But I would note the reason the Casey Foundation pursued this research was with all of the positive movement around criminal justice reform, there was less attention paid to the collateral effects on families. As to what really popped out for us, I think to some degree it's the depth of the issue. As you mentioned, there are 82,000 children in Maryland who've had a parent incarcerated. Excuse me. There are 5 million nationally. I'd note also that we were surprised and, to some degree, disheartened by the degree of the number of parents who are in prison. Our study showed that 45% of men age 24 and younger are fathers who are in prison, 48% of women in federal prison, 55% in mothers. And as you might expect from those young parents, that there are young children. The majority of kids with parents in prison are younger than 10. And ultimately, I think what we need to pay attention to, and I think understand the depth of the challenge, is that having a parent who's incarcerated has a traumatic effect on a child equivalent to domestic violence, abuse, or divorce, something that can stay with a child throughout their development.
If that was one of the things that struck me, is your assertion and showing some evidence that it's not, it ain't over when the parent comes home.
Sure.
What, Joe Jones, how do you see that play out among your clients?
Well, you know, the glass is half empty, half full. And what I mean by that, we are finally, as a society, thinking about, particularly for those incarcerated parents, we're thinking about how to set up a strategy, an effective strategy, to manage their return back to society. What we used to do, and we're still struggling to find out improved ways of doing this, we used to simply just release a person from incarceration with no ID, no sense of whether or not they had a place to go to upon release. And we had expectations that they would reunite with their families, get connected to the labor force, with huge barriers to labor force attachment, just thinking about having a criminal record as one barrier to labor force attachment. That was the most ludicrous approach to trying to help with the quality of life in a community. To make it real relative to Baltimore, our organization, the Center for Urban Families, is located in zip code 21217. That also encompasses Sandtown, Winchester. So we're located on Monroe Street. We're right across the street from New Shiloh Baptist Church, where Freddie Gray's funeral was held. A couple blocks down from Mondawmin Mall, that would be zip code 21217, and go up further up Park Heights towards Pimlico Racecourse. North Avenue, going to the west, landmark will be Coppin State University. Those three zip codes, 21215, 21216, and 21217, three contiguous neighborhoods, those happen to be three of the top zip codes people released from incarceration come back to. There are also approximately 4,000 non-custodial parents, almost all fathers, who owe more than $26 million in back state-owed child support. So if you think about the fact that you've got that level, that number of people returning from incarceration, that level of debt, and the majority of those people with that debt happen to be parents that have had some criminal justice experience, there's literally no way you can expect a good outcome from that if we don't have a system, a criminal justice system that is, yes, it comes down, you know, tough on crime in the appropriate ways. You know, we should not have zero tolerance policies. We're just sucking up large numbers of people from our community for relatively minor crimes and then incarcerating them. You know, there are a lot of people that should not be incarcerated, particularly for minor drug-related offenses. We can do a better job of addressing those issues from a community-based standpoint and then figuring out how do we adjust our criminal justice system so the most violent people are incarcerated and we don't spend the inordinate amount of money warehousing people when we can put that into services and treatment, and particularly drug treatment.
There's a lot more to talk about. We need to take a quick break here, and we've got lots more questions for Joe Jones, president of the Center for Urban Families in Baltimore, and Ryan Chow, vice president for Civic Sites and Community Change at the Annie E. Casey Foundation, headquartered here in Baltimore. We're talking about their new report about the effect of prison sentences on kids. You can join this conversation. We'd love to hear from you if incarceration has had an effect on your family or on a family that you're close to. Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about the side effects of incarceration, what it can do to families. My guests are Joe Jones, president of the Center for Urban Families, and Ryan Chow, vice president for Civic Sites and Community Change at the Annie E. Casey Foundation. The foundation just released a report about incarceration and families. I want to pick up on a a point you made a minute ago, Joe Jones. You were talking about the effect of incarceration on families and on their finances. I mean, one of the things that is recommended in this report, you were talking about child support. One of the things the report suggests is that child support should be suspended while the parent who's been paying child support is incarcerated. What does that do to the family that's counting on that child support to raise the kid?
Sure, I can start, and I'm sure Joe has some real-world experiences to add to it. But I think that, well, first of all, what we found in our research was that 65% of families with a member in prison could not meet basic needs, could not make the most fundamental of needs met financially.
And part of that presumably is because child support has effectively stopped the parent goes into prison if the parent's been paying child support.
That's right. I think the complexity of the issue is that the parent in prison cannot make those payments. They don't have an income to then contribute. But what happens when the parent is in prison is those payments essentially accrue ultimately in the form of debt when someone is released. And so they're essentially accruing costs that they didn't have an income to fund. They are released from prison, often struggle to get employment or other income, and then not only have then the renewal of child support payments, but this massive debt that is in reality can't be repaid, but simply is an added burden. There are places like in California where they in fact have suspended the accrual of child support payments for people who are incarcerated for those who are sentenced more than 3 months and demonstrate they're not able to repay.
So, Joe Jones, the families that you work with, essentially, child support isn't happening anyway while the parent is incarcerated. Is it a good thing for that family going forward if there's not a debt that has built up of past child support payments? Or is it better to wipe that slate clean?
Well, first of all, you did need to distinguish between child support that's owed back to the state versus child support that's owed directly to the mom, right? Meaning that, the children and the mom receive some kind of welfare payments, some welfare benefits, which lead to state-owed child support. That money that the dad or the custodial parent is paying back doesn't go to the family. It goes back to the state. So we do in the state of Maryland, we did pass legislation, and we do have the opportunity that when you go into incarceration, you can request that your payments stop after some period of incarceration. So we've got momentum in that area. We also are very fortunate that the Maryland Department of Human Resources has been very flexible in working with us. We have an initiative and partnership we've done with them called ROLL, which basically allows someone who is a low-income dad, typically earning less than $10,000, who owes huge amounts of child support, often because they have been incarcerated, to come out to participate in a work activity, to get a job where they have a pay stub and they're paying back their original order, and the state can forgive the amount that had accrued during their incarceration. So in effect, what you're coming up with is a fair and kind of a balanced way to say, hey, here's an incentive for you to stay connected to the labor force. Because what you don't want to do is to simply overlay a criminal justice approach to child support debt, where you push them further underground and you put their backs up against the wall, and then end up, reverting back to behavior that got them incarcerated in the first place. And then it continues to disconnect mm-hmm. them from their children, families, and community.
Gotcha. Let me tell our listeners, you can be part of this conversation. We'd love to hear what your thoughts are about this. How can children best overcome the challenges that are brought on by having an incarcerated parent? What should communities be doing? What should the state be doing and the city? We've got lots of people who do want to be part of this conversation. Kay is calling us from Catonsville. Kay, welcome to Midday.
Hi. My thought was changing the punishment, so instead of everybody just going to jail.
Changing the punishment?
Sure. So the punishment should fit the crime. And so for low-level crimes, not everybody's going to jail. So if somebody causes physical damage, you know, injury to another person, then they have their punishment versus going to jail is going to go and take help take care of them. So the punishment is to experience the consequence of their crime. So one, they're not going to jail, which is going to save tax dollars. They're getting really feeling the impact of their crime. And, you know, everything else that you're putting into this, I was thinking that might make a bigger impact and a bigger difference.
Kay, I appreciate the suggestion. You're basically suggesting that the state should be more creative in the kinds of punishments it meets out. Thanks for the call. What do either of you think about Kay's idea? Or do you see any signs of it happening?
Well, I would say I think one thing that's encouraging, if I understood the call correctly, was what was just passed in the last legislative session in Maryland, the Justice Reinvestment Act, which did look at restructuring penalties related to drug convictions, eliminating mandatory minimums on certain sentences. So essentially, I think there's positive reform in terms of more accurately the sentence meeting the extent of the crime. I think one thing I'd note, though, that is one of the continuing challenges is that in many cases, I'll give you an example, landlords in many cases will have blanket bans on eligibility for housing for any kind of criminal background. So even if a sentence is more fairly meted out, ultimately just having that record can lead to mass discrimination on eligibility for basic needs, regardless of how long someone served.
And if I read the report correctly, you say that I think it's states or localities can get a waiver from that ban on formerly incarcerated people getting housing subsidies, correct?
Well, I think what we noted was one is that at the federal level, there are very few mandated restrictions on housing eligibility for public housing, for one. But that the recently passed Fair Housing Act, in fact, goes farther. And Secretary Castro just a few weeks ago came out with a statement of HUD's intent of really pushing on landlords to have justifiable reasons for disallowing housing eligibility, only in cases where they can say that the person's criminal record can give a reasonable expectation that there would be some kind of risk posed.
Dennis has called us from Hartford City. Dennis, welcome to Midday.
Yeah, it's calling from Hartford County.
Oh, Hartford County.
My feeling is that we're getting too far away from personal responsibility. It's disturbing to hear some of what I'm hearing from your guest. When I think of all the different societies I've been in, 48 countries, living abroad and so forth, and I'm hearing a case here where people do not wish to take responsibility for their own poor decisions and the ramifications that result. I do believe we must address the issue of very minor drug activity and so forth. But if you're selling heroin, which kills people and so forth, no, that's pretty major from my perspective. But I'm very concerned that we don't address with young people from the beginning, at least as I did in my home with three children, that you are responsible for your consequences. And those consequences are things like being away from your family, whether you do it as an adult or that the children are, you know, they miss their mom and dad when their mom and dad make bad decisions. So I don't want to be redundant. I could speak on this for a half an hour, but it's very, very disturbing that people would even think we should condone, because the one person even admitted that he has been in and out of prison. So obviously he not only made a bad decision, which one might be able to give some, the judge might give some breaks, and I think in most cases they do, but he continued to make bad decisions.
Dennis, I appreciate your raising this, and I know both of my guests said they were not arguing against all incarceration of parents. So, Joe Jones, you made that point already. How would you respond to Dennis?
Well, you know, Dennis, you know, raises an important moral question. And I would not, you know, push back hard against Dennis to say that people who commit crimes should be punished. The question is, you know, what is the appropriate level of punishment, particularly for so many people who are incarcerated for minor offenses? You know, you got to be really honest in this conversation. Incarcerating people in our country is big business. While we are sitting here having this conversation, there are people who represent the prison industrial complex, the prison construction construction business, and management of privatizing a business with huge lobbyists. They're pushing against any kind of reform like the Justice and the Reinvestment Act because it is profitable to warehouse people. And we have too many people who are in prison that cost huge amounts of money to warehouse them, but the crime is relatively minor. And I would say to Dennis that, you know, the whole issue around distribution of drugs, it is such a common phenomenon in many places around the country, not just in urban America, but in other places. And I don't think that we want to default to a society that simply says because you are selling drugs that we want to lock you up, throw away the key, and we don't want to think about how we manage your redemption, and we don't want to throw away the key to the point where we don't think about the impact it has on your children.
That's Joe Jones, the head of the founder of this Center for Urban Families here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with me is Ryan Chow, vice president of the Annie Casey Foundation, which has just issued a report on incarcerated parents and the effect on their families. Joy is calling us from Pasadena. Joy, welcome to Midday.
Yes, I'm the mother of two very addicted daughters, and at one period of my life, I had to take in their children. But the support, and they do commit crimes, there's no doubt about it, when they're using drugs, because the need for drugs is stronger than the need for their children. That's how strong drug addiction is. I've been in the program myself for 25 years, because it started with alcoholism in my family, and it is a family disease, and addiction is a disease. It controls the mind, thought patterns, and it gives you no hope. Incarcerating somebody that I went through the system in Jessup's and federal prisons and things did not help my daughter until she received, she went through Gardensia down in prison system, and she got clean and sober. And from there on, somebody had to support her. There, she couldn't find housing for her and her son, and her son participated together with all of us. It's got to be participants. There's no getting around it.
Joy, I appreciate your calling us. Thank you. Ryan, what about Joy's points, much of what she had to say had to do with drug addiction, but also what happens when you get out of prison?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think part of what Joy noted was that the importance of supports for parents while in prison, the opportunities for both substance abuse support as well as support with substance abuse dependency, as well as job training programs. But as I mentioned earlier, I think one of the real challenges is that after someone has served their sentence, in many cases, families continue to serve that sentence, whether it's the challenge in getting gainful employment, reality in many states that there are lifetime bans for people with felony drug convictions for their entire families, and also that the ability to find housing can be very challenging, especially with private landlords, but even with some public housing authorities.
Robin has called us from Baltimore. Robin, welcome to the show. Robin? Is Robin with us? We may have lost Robin. She was going to tell us that her husband had been incarcerated, and her daughter wrote a book about the experience. Joe Jones, what are some of the things that help a kid cope? You talked to us a few minutes ago about a kid head hitting the pillow trying to process the visit they had with their parent, incarcerated parent that day. What helps with that?
Well, you know, there are, you know, folks who run some of our jails and prisons, wardens, if you would want to use a common terminology, who are very creative, very open, very reform-oriented, who create connections between the incarcerated parent and their children slash families. So some folks are doing video conferencing so that a child can actually conference into the institution and have a video connection with the child. There are some
between the child and the parent.
There are institutions that, as Randolia was saying in the intro, that will, particularly in minimum institutions, allowing families to come in to allow some physical contact. The problem is it's not universal. We don't have a set of standards. We don't have a universal approach to thinking about how do we assess the parental situation? How does the institution have a set of practices that are conducive for wanting to help the parent to manage that relationship between the child? Because what we don't want to do is have the relationship severed and completely disconnected, and then you wait until the parent is released from incarceration and try to reunite. There's just too much distance. There's too much pain. There's too much sense of an abandonment from children, and that abandonment, you know, it leads to resentment towards the parent, and the parent comes out and tries his or her best to reconnect with that family, and it's painful, and sometimes it's so painful that the parent just, you know, pushes back and just doesn't know how to, you know, how to engage, and so they let the relationship go, and then that child grows up feeling hurt and abandoned. And I had a woman tell me, one of our grads would tell me, hurt people hurt people. And what we don't want to do is to see parents continuously being in a situation where they aren't effectively reunited with their families.
Hurt people hurt people.
People, yep.
We need to take another break here. Lots more to talk about with our guests about this new report from the Annie Casey Foundation about the impact of incarceration on families and what could be done to minimize those effects. What about you? Did you grow up with a parent in prison? Tell us about it. Do you think visitation rules should be relaxed for parents? We'd love to hear from you. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. This is Midday. We're talking about a new report from the Annie E. Casey Foundation about how incarceration has an effect on kids, families, and communities. I'm speaking with Joe Jones, president of the Center for Urban Families here in Baltimore, and Ryan Chow, vice president for Civic Sites and Community Change at the Annie E. Casey Foundation, which issued this report. You can be part of this conversation. Do you think courts should take the family circumstances of a person convicted of a crime into account when sentencing and when deciding where that person will serve a sentence? How can children be spared some of the impact of the incarceration? Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Danny has called us from Catonsville. Danny, welcome to Midday.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, this is addressed to you and to the panel. I am a step, well, not by marriage, but the thing is I've been raising a child. His father was incarcerated for 14 years. He was released in December and is already back in prison again, being reclassified. There's so many points that I could make, and I think I just got to try to concentrate on one point here. But I think it's a real tragedy, because what happens is these people are incarcerated. They actually come out worse than when they went in, if they're in there for any long period of time. So they're institutionalized. They try to make this reintegration or reentry into society. They don't have the infrastructure around them. So it's real easy for people from the outside looking in that came from good families to say, well, why do these people, you know, end up back in prison? That's a much more complex issue. But I guess the thing that I really wanted to concentrate on was they should be trying to give them some type of skill or something while they're in prison, so that they have something to come out to make some kind of contribution to society. That's my point.
Danny, thank you for calling. You want to respond to Danny?
I can start. I would say he's absolutely right. And I think there's, you know, we talked a little bit about the importance of job training and other services that can support folks when they leave. It's also important to provide counseling and simply supportive parenting services because when those bonds break, it can be very hard to even know how to reconnect to a child who's not only suffering often different forms of trauma and financial difficulty, is also dealing with stigma in their own community, in their schools. There's a program called the National Fatherhood Initiative's Inside Out Dad program that does just that, that helps incarcerated parents really kind of continue to work on their parenting skills.
One of the recommendations in the report about job training is to perhaps focus less on traditional fields like construction and manufacturing, where ex-offenders are often channeled, and instead look at newer skill sets, and also a recommendation to make available training in the skills needed to start a business. Joe Jones, what do you think of those recommendations? Does that seem, from your experience, the right way to go?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, you need a continuum of opportunities for folks. There's some folks who need entry-level opportunities. You know, they just don't have the work experience, and they have criminal records, which makes them, at least for some employers, high liability, liabilities to hire. So you want them to take an initial opportunity. But I've had, you know, young men, one young man in particular who he came out. He worked for an exterminator company, and he went on to get his own certification. He started his own company. We worked with him to clean up his credit, and he went on to become a homeowner in Baltimore City. And so I think when you provide the requisite, you know, level of support, and we recognize that we just don't want to continuously allow people to be released from incarceration without the requisite skill sets. One of the things that we try to do is to do exit interviews, where we actually will go into the prison setting and start assessing people before they get released so that we can have a plan for them upon release and not wait until they hit the street and then try to catch up after the fact. Once a person is released, they got to start meeting their daily needs. And if they don't have a way to connect to services, supports, and reconnect with their families, we're setting them up to fail. And I think that's not the right approach that we want to take. We want to manage, you know, what takes place in prison. We want to manage what happens as a person is exiting incarceration.
Bill has called us from Westminster. Bill, welcome to Midday.
Good morning. Or afternoon, should I say. Hey, when I grew up, I engaged in drugs. I drank a great deal. I even sold drugs a little bit. But where I lived, I didn't really have that constant police presence where, you know, where every time I walked out of the door, there was police down the street, or if I got in my car, the slightest infraction, stop and frisk and everything. I've never been arrested. I'm 60 years old now. And I've never been arrested for any reason. I engaged in all the ills of the world, and I understand. But if I grew up in an urban area, I would probably have been arrested numerous times simply because of where I lived.
Bill, I appreciate your making that point. I suspect both of my guests agree with you. I don't know whether you want to add something to that.
No, race definitely plays a factor. When you look at Baltimore City as an example, where we had zero tolerance policies, and we simply applied that, particularly in Baltimore City, where the demographic is largely African American, and we arrested so many people, and as a result of those arrests for relatively minor frivolous crimes, even the state's attorney's office refused to prosecute those crimes, but those people still had an arrest record. So even though they were not prosecuted, they had an arrest record, which still makes them less likely to be employed, which then places a person, the burden on a person to try to get employed, making it higher, the standard higher for them to get hired than their counterparts who happen to be of another ethnicity, and in most cases white. And so we can't ignore the fact that race plays a factor in some of the disparities that we've been talking about here. And, you know, I think it's an open conversation, and nobody should be naive to think that race doesn't play a role in the conversation.
Right, and you started us off this hour talking about three zip codes with a great concentration of incarceration. The N.E. Casey Foundation report talks about some of the effects of incarceration affecting the community, even families which themselves do not have somebody in prison end up with some of the spillover effect.
Sure. Yeah, I think it's race and place play prominent roles. And certainly I think part of this has to do with police presence, as noted before. I think the disproportionate burden placed on community organizations who are really providing stability in those neighborhoods. And there's just data as to the disproportionate effects by race. African-American kids are 7 times more likely than white kids nationally to have a parent incarcerated. Latino children, 2 times more likely.
Twice as likely. Mary has called us from Bel Air. Mary, welcome to Midday.
Yes. Hello.
Hello.
I am calling because I would like to hear more about how I can support and help my grandchildren who are struggling with their father being in prison. Their depression, their anger, it's really difficult. And we need to be better counselmen how to help these children while their father is absent. You know, I hear all the discussion and it's all wonderful, but you're not helping me who's trying to help the children. So I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Okay, Mary, thank you for posing that question. Joe Jones, how would you answer Mary?
You know, the trauma, what she in effect is talking about, she's talking about trauma, family trauma, community trauma. And we've only recently began to identify trauma as a major impediment to the issues that the caller just referenced in terms of, you know, what's taking place with the children, what's taking place with her as a caregiver. One, we've got to increase the level of connection between service providers, families, and clinical professionals. We are now having conversations in the community. We just held a community conversation a couple of months ago at the center with the community and mental health professionals to talk about trauma-informed care. And so in part what we're talking about, how do we now make accessible to a family like the callers access to medical professionals, clinical professionals that can help with the appropriate credentials to be able to work with a family that's experiencing that kind of trauma. We just can't accept that the fact that it's happening is just normal.
And Mary has left us. I don't know exactly where Mary lives, but if she needs to reach out to somebody, does it make sense to reach out to a church? How does she tap into the professional skills that you just referenced? How can she make what's a likely way to make a connection?
Well, here if she's in the city, and I'm not sure, like you said, I'm not sure where she is, but in any jurisdiction, you know, your health department can be a first call relative to getting connected to mental health professionals in your community. And then there are also service providers. The United Way has a 211 call center that also is accessible or makes services accessible. Those are starting places depending on what jurisdiction you're in.
Stuart is calling us from Baltimore. Stuart, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So as I'm listening to this conversation, you know, it just strikes me as not really all that newsworthy in terms of it's the same message that choices have consequences and bad choices have bad consequences. And I'm just curious as to what's being done on the front end of this problem in terms of, like, educating young kids about maybe not having children until you have a job and you can support them, and maybe, you know, not committing crimes unless you're ready to go to jail and serve your time and deal with the consequences when you get out.
Interesting.
Maybe basically, you made your bed, now sleep in it. That's my attitude.
Let me ask Ryan Chow of the N.E. Casey Foundation to respond to the point you raised, Stuart. Thank you.
Well, that's not necessarily the focus of this report. I think it's a fair statement that we need to be also focusing on preventative measures, whether that's and I think there's positive movement even here in Baltimore in terms of the reduction of teen pregnancy, of the importance of two-generation approaches serving both kids and families. So I think it's a fair point, but I think the point we're trying to make, what newsworthy or not, is that there are essentially innocent kids and families that pay the price as part of this our broader approaches on mass incarceration and criminal justice, and that needs to be more part of the conversation.
You probably saw the comment on the Annie Casey website about this. About your report from someone who called herself Sarah 56, who said in part, they are not good parents and kids are not get out of jail free cards. The parents sure did not consider them when committing the crime. The kids would be better off without them, this person wrote. Joe Jones, what do you say to someone like that?
You know, I'm an ex-offender. I'm a recovering addict. I happen to be someone who had benefited from the kind of services that we're kind of like talking about. You know, I at one point was not such a good person, but with the support of my community and the God of my understanding, I found a way to turn my life around and be a productive citizen. And I know many people, including the folks that we serve at the Center for Urban Families and other organizations that are in part supported by the Annie Casey Foundation. So we're using data and information to inform policy. We are also asking parents to step up and be the best that they can for their children and their families. But it's really difficult for me to sit back and realize that, you know, we have so many people in our community who've fallen short, and we think that not supporting them, not asking ourselves, you know, is it a better investment to help them turn their lives around, or is it a better position to step back and say, hey, you made your bed, you lay in it? I just don't think as a society we want to take that approach, given some of the disparities that we know about and the fact that we are a country of redemption.
Ryan Chow, what do you most hope people take from this report?
Well, I think I just actually wanted to, I was reflecting on two of the previous callers, Bill and Mary, who were kind of asking about how could they better support the children they'd stepped in to help care for. I just want to note that I think we also need to support people like Bill and Mary, who are stepping in and really doing extraordinary things while a parent is away. But ultimately, I think what the point that we want to make is that, one is that kids suffer a sentence along with their parents when they're incarcerated. There are financial effects. There are trauma effects. But ultimately, it's shame and isolation that we need to help all families deal with.
Well, I think this report begins to help us, to remind us about that. So I'm grateful to you both for the time you spent with us. Ryan Chow, Vice President for Civic Sites and Community Change at the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Joe Jones, President of the Center for Urban Families. I really appreciate your sharing this conversation. Thanks.
Thank you, Sheila.
And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow for a conversation about women in comedy. In an age of Tina Fey, Amy Schumer, Sarah Silverman, what's funny and not funny about being a funny lady? That's tomorrow on Midday. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.